final one, 45.
45, authorize the rates and charges for water and water-related services during the fiscal year beginning July 1, 2014 to June 30, 2015, and fix an effective date.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm David Schaff. I'm the director of the Portland Water Bureau, and with me is Cecilia Hoon, the finance director for the Portland Water Bureau. The Water Bureau, just as a quick reminder, has the two largest finished drinking water supplies in the state of Oregon, the Bull Run Watershed and the Columbia South Shore Wellfield, both capable of providing our average daily demand of around 100 million gallons a day. Like BES, we have a lot of pipe. We have about 2,200 miles worth of pipes. Although we're mostly gravity-fed, we have 38 pump stations. We supply water to approximately a quarter of the state's population. We have 63 tanks and covered reservoirs. We have 177,000 meters and 14,000 hydrants. And we have 133 Benson bubblers. So let's talk a little bit about our budget. Our overall budget for this coming fiscal year is $177 million. Operating expenses of around $80 million. We have an ongoing reduction this year of about $1.4 million. Commissioner Fish mentioned that 2.5% operating budget reductions that we made. Most of those are trying to reduce our budget by realigning the proposed budgets to our current spending levels. Some of the impact of that, though, is our reduction in our ability to respond to unforeseen circumstances. So we did not have a particularly bad main break season this year. We didn't have a turbidity event. Those are things that were a little closer to the margin, and we'll have to stretch a little harder if we have those events next year. We reduced a number of positions. We're eliminating 11 positions, trying to absorb those duties or redistribute them among staff. We've reduced part-time funding. We've reduced our travel and training budget. We've made some changes to our funding levels, things like the lead hazard reduction program, our condition assessments, and realigned our budget to fit maintenance and repair activities that can't easily be capitalized. On our capital improvement plan, we have a CIP of just under $97 million, reflects a reduction of $14.1 million. We've pushed out about $8 million worth of conduit work to allow for planning to be completed and construction of conduit interties before we attempt to do rehabilitation. We moved out about $2 million in habitat conservation plan work. The rest is related to revised project timing and cash flow. We, as I said, eliminated 11 positions in our overall budget as well. Our retail revenue is $149 million. Retail is $126.6 million. Wholesale is $16.6 million. Other fees and charges are 4.3, and our SDCs are 1.8 million. Our total staffing is 564 with that reduction of 11 positions. So the primary rate drivers for us in this upcoming fiscal year, we have the surplus fund balance. So our prior year savings and increased revenues from SDCs, mains, and service installations, the economy is clearly coming back. We can see that in the number of services that we're providing, the number of mains that we're installing, what we call petition mains. We've seen a decrease in our operating budget savings, or we've seen savings in our operating budget, and as I said, those increased fees. We've had to adjust to a higher cost of living component, as you know. We are still adjusting to lower retail demand. This year, we're projecting about a 2% reduction in our overall demand. That's about 375 million gallons.
Is that mostly because of conservation efforts?
Conservation, price, plumbing code, all of those things together, you cannot buy the old-style toilet tank anymore. Most people are buying front-loading washers. All of those things are water-saving devices. We are still lowering our demand projections. We have one more year where we're going to lower our projection by another percent, and then we hope to see our demand more or less flattening out. on our capital improvement plan. We are still working on distribution system repairs and rehabilitation, replacement of those pipes, the hydrants, the pump stations, services, that sort of thing. And, of course, we have our reservoir projects and the interstate facility rehab. So our rate summary for 2014-15, we're looking at a 7% increase or about $1.93 a month for our typical residential customer. Our system development charges are more or less flat. For our most common meter size, we're seeing a $2 increase. For our larger meters, we're actually seeing decreases. From our fixed fees and lower and charges, many of our fees are lower. We've had a lower billable overhead rate, and we've made a number of organizational efficiencies that have been enabled us to bring our charges for other things down. So how does our rate affect our typical customer? One thing, Commissioner Novick, we actually have seen an increase in the number of low-income participants over the last several years, and I think that's pretty obviously due to the recession. We used to budget for 10,000 participants and came nowhere near that. Now we're coming closer and closer to the expected numbers. And Commissioner Fritz, you're correct. The low-income discount applies only to owner-occupied. So there is a group of people that we do not reach. If you live in an apartment building, you're not a customer of the Portland Water Bureau. It's the owner of the property that's the customer. And we've struggled with that, and we've tried to work on ways to extend some sort of low-income discount to multifamily residences. But, frankly, we have not been able to solve that particular
David,
problem.
David, is the principal challenge there that in a multifamily low-income property, the individual units are not metered?
That, and of course, there's no way to guarantee that whatever discount we give to the owner of the property gets passed along to that low-income resident. But yes, most there's one, typically one master meter at those sites.
I will say that the industries representing developers of affordable housing have been interested in engaging us in this conversation for a long time. And while there are some technical reasons why the Water Bureau hasn't done it in the past, I think it's worthy of a discussion about seeing whether, just like we did a little bit of a workaround to start moving to monthly billing generally, you know, without replacing everyone's meter, there might be some best practices we can draw upon. So that's on my list for this next year, something to take a good hard look at. And I hope to also engage Commissioner Saltzman in that discussion.
And David and Commissioner, I mean, since we are on cable TV and since Channel 2 is here, it might be worth just sort of reading out. If you're a single person who makes under $1,809 a month, you're eligible for a discount. If you're a couple making under $2,365 a month, then you're eligible for a discount. If you're three people making under $2,922, you're eligible for a discount. If you're a family of four making under $3,478 a month, you're eligible for a discount.
Thank you. I didn't bring that with me. I appreciate that. Our typical customers, we use 500 cubic feet, and that's approximately 3,700 gallons a month. Our typical residential customer will see their monthly bill go up by about $1.93. The typical qualifying low-income residential customer will see go up by 97 cents. A medium-sized commercial customer, and that's a grocery store like an Albertsons or a chain restaurant like a McDonald's, that uses 100 cubic... 100 CCF, thank you. That's approximately 75,000 gallons. We'll see a monthly increase of about $26.30. A large commercial customer like the Port of Portland uses about 11 million gallons a month. They'll see about a $3,500 increase. And our largest retail customer, Siltronix, will see an approximate $14,000 a month increase. But that's for 44 million gallons of water every single month. So Portland water bills represent only about 5% of the typical monthly utility services for residential customers. I was hoping that Michael was going to be presenting something that would nudge them just higher than us so we'd be at the bottom, but they managed to sneak in just under us. But as you can see, of all the critical utilities that one has to have. We are the cheapest, and when you compare to those things that people don't have to have, like cell phones, cable TV, internet service, we are a bargain. How do we compare? We look at a variety of metrics, but as you can see, from a regional standpoint, we are right about in the middle in comparison. When we compare our typical customers to typical customers of other jurisdictions, if we use the exact same metric where our typical customer and we apply our customer to some other utilities rates, we're still right about in the middle. And although we didn't bring this chart, you've seen the chart in our rate hearing. When you look at us from a national standpoint, we're right about in the middle from a customer standpoint.
Just curious, while we're on the slide, how many of those other providers are wholesale customers of ours?
Rockwood, Tualatin, TVWD, parts of Beaverton probably, Gresham, Tigard. So most of them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And then we did look at the combined chart, and you see that here. And as you can see, that in regionally, that does push us up toward the upper end when we're looking at our overall water and sewer and stormwater water rates combined. And then finally, I've never understood this, but everybody likes to compare our system development charges. And, well, I know why I like to compare it is because we're probably one of the lowest in the regions. There are very few. There's only one water system in the state or regionally that has a lower SDC than we do. So we're very proud of that. And with that, I'm prepared to answer questions.
Mayor, a couple comments. The Eugene Water District, which was over the last 6-7 months used as a model in another public debate we had, recently announced a 6% increase in their water rates. So that gives you a comparison with.
And we are currently just slightly above them at our proposed rate of $29.54. They are at $24.85, so they're working hard on catching up to us.
Question I had, though, builds off a question the mayor just asked about wholesale customers. In one of the earlier slides, you indicated that we get about $16.6 million of annual revenue from our wholesale customers. And, David, you've explained to me that long-term, one way that we can help to stabilize rates is by selling more water to our wholesale customers. So can you just give us a quick primer? How many wholesale customers do we have? And just the math as to why that is a important growth area for us if we want to stabilize rates.
Well, Dean, actually, it was Mike. No, it was Dean that talked about it. Jim was talking about it. The more units you sell, the smaller the rate can be. So the more customers, the more water we're able to sell, the more customers we have, the more we'll be able to spread it out among a larger base. We sell about, looking at customer class, we have revenue of about $141 million. 42% of that comes from our residential customers. 13% of that comes from our residential or multifamily customers, and that's clearly what's growing these days. I mean, that's what's being built in Portland are multifamily residences. Commercial and industrial accounts from the tiniest commercial building that has just one bathroom and a sink up to Siltronics makes up about 33%, but wholesale customers make about 12%, and we have 20 wholesale customers right now.
So one of the things we're hearing regionally, Mayor and colleagues, is there are some of our wholesale customers which would rather own than rent and are going their own way, making enormous bets on new capital equipment so they can pull water from rivers and own their system. One of our tasks, it seems to me, is to convince wholesale customers that that being a long-term renter off of our system, accessing the best water in the country, is in their long-term interest and can keep their rates down. But that's obviously, in terms of our business model, that's an area we're going to pay particular attention to. The David, in a typical hot summer's day, how much water do we sell?
Well, our peak days have been the last several years in the 150 million gallons a day range. When I first started, they were close to 180 million.
Okay, and if you take our capacity off the Bull Run and you add the extra 100 million gallons a day that we can sell folks from Columbia Well Water, what's our total capacity?
If we are rocking and rolling, we could do over 300 million gallons a day.
So that's the good news side of the equation, plentiful mm-hmm. water. And the challenge is, how can we sell more to it to our wholesale customers in order long-term to stabilize rates? And putting it perhaps cup half empty, how do we discourage some of our wholesale customers from leaving the system, which will have the effect of shifting those costs to everyone else?
Commissioner, I think I've said this before, but I think the obvious answer is negative advertising. If the Water Bureau would just simply run ads attacking the water supplies that our neighboring jurisdictions either have or are considering and say they have the alternative good, clean, Bull Run water, I think their populations would rise up and we'd get what we need.
Love that. Thank you.
That's the kind of marketing a municipality probably can't do, right? Is it?
And David, just one other
thing. I think I'll pass, but okay.
Put the water just in one more context for us. If I go to the grocery store and buy a gallon of water, depending on whether it's no brand or high end, I can pay anywhere from $2 to $4 a gallon or something like that. What does a gallon of water cost our typical residential customer?
Commissioner, I'm so glad you said that or asked that. I spent a whole day with Matt Moles' seventh grade science class at Beaumont Elementary, and that was one of the questions that I was posing to them. And I just happened to have 2.17 gallons with me, 2 gallon jugs and a pint or a liter jug. And I said, how much does this cost? I can tell you right now, if you buy it off the shelf at Fred Meyer, the cheapest you'll pay is 99 cents for that gallon. How much do you guys think it costs for me to deliver it to your parents' faucet, wherever there's a faucet in the room? And I had, $50, $20, $30, $10, $5. I said, come on, you guys, think. It's not that, it's a lot lower than that. And I get down to 15, 20 cents. It's 2.17 gallons per penny.
The penny.
Water is cheap.
Delivered to someone's house.
Delivered to your door, delivered to every single faucet in your house. 2.17 gallons per penny. If you have any more questions.
Thank you.
That's a good one. All right, any others? Thank you both. And then let's see if our team from PERB is ready.
Good afternoon again. We have a couple of brief written recommendations. John, do you want to?
Oh, sure. On water. PERB recommends that the Mayor and City Council accept the 2014 proposed budget from the Water Bureau. This proposed budget will lead to a rate increase in the fiscal year of 7%, $1.93 per month for a typical residential customer. Members of the PERB Water Committee attended the Budget Advisory Committee as non-voting members. The Portland Water Bureau staff presented a substantial amount of information on every capital improvement project for the committee to review. We want to thank and acknowledge to the Water Bureau staff for being so well prepared for this process, for being very responsive to the requests from both BAC and the members of the public who attended, and for their transparency in the process. And carrying on the thought that I gave you a little bit earlier, I would say the transparency is in the work that the Water Bureau staff has done to make a lot of their material very understandable. And they need that. They should be complimented for it, and BES is working at it, and they need support to get to the same level. And I'm just going to hit a couple of comments. I think I live. My law office is out in Tigard, so I live in Tigard, if you know what I mean. I think the people in Tigard are really going. We're not going to have to do negative advertising when the water bill comes due in the city of Tigard. Where they're headed on rate increases by abandoning our system and owning with, along with Lake Oswego is going to be a shock to those people, because the numbers I've seen are going to put them way up high. I don't want to quote them exactly, but they're going to be significant. And the other thing, and this is the old water lawyer in me talking, is if you look at what they've got, the call they've got on the Clackamas River, when Lake Oswego and Tiger get down into a hot, dry September, and what they're going to have to be saying to the people trying to maintain their lawns out in Tiger in the next couple of years when they're plugged in. They've got a real low call on that river, and that river is basically an uncontrolled river, and so they're not going to be looking at a real vigorous source of supply when it gets right down to it. So if we just keep play our cards close and just say, look, we've got something where we can bring the $300 million when we have to, I think in a few years people are going to appreciate it in Washington County.
Interesting. Thank you.
I'd like to add just a comment, not directly related to Water Bureau or rates at all, but I know in our work session a couple of months ago, we discussed at length the issue of PERB membership, and I'd like to bring that up again simply because there are only four of us serving out of nine possible slots, and I think that we may have had a couple of applicants recently, so we may actually be able to grow in membership soon. But I'd like to reiterate and encourage council members to provide assistance to us in recruiting. You know, it's a lot of work to do, and having only four of us to do it is, you know, gets to be a bit burdensome. And to that end, I know that Mayor Hales, you've talked about assembling the Blue Ribbon panel for investigating future oversight of right. Water Bureau and VES, and I'd kind of like to, stress that the infrastructure is in place for oversight if it's done right. If the PERB becomes stronger through greater membership mm-hmm. and through the involvement of CUB, I don't think there are a whole lot of changes that need to be made if we utilize what we already have more effectively.
Good point. Thank you. One last thing I on that subject, and it was really on the solid waste thing. In order for us to function the last couple of months, there's a couple of former members of PERB. That was Janice Adler, who was our chair for a significant period of time, and then Vince
Zalewski,
okay, who did the yeoman's work on the solid waste part of this thing. And in the spring, in order for us to have a quorum, even though their terms were, they were interim members, they came back and helped us vote and look at these issues, and they really deserve a compliment after their service coming back and helping out. So thank you
both for your service.
Yeah, we really appreciate your time and effort. Thank you. Okay, then let's take public testimony and then PERB, or you want to take PERB? Yeah. CUB. So let's have the panel from the Citizens Utility Board come up and talk to us about both of these rate ordinances, and we appreciate your oversight very much. It's going to be a panel of one, but we appreciate
panel
you being here.
Jeff might come up later.
Okay.
Okay. And there is a handout, so, and Jeff has some for. So I'm Janice Thompson with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. For 30 years, CUB has been protecting the wallets of residential ratepayers with a focus on the private phone and energy utilities. And we're very pleased to turn this experience towards analysis and ratepayer advocacy on Portland's water and wastewater utilities. I think we take a systems approach that recognizes the need of cost-effective management overall, and that seems particularly important here given the range of customers of the Bureau of Environmental Services and the Water Bureau. So I want to start by asking you to think about two numbers, 1,085 and 5. It looks like there's about 1,085 positions at the Water Bureau and BES. Now, no big organization in either the private sector or the public sector it only has ideal, perfect employees. But I just want to, you know, as I've jumped in on this and have been talking with folks, I've just been really impressed with their level of interest, knowledge, and commitment, and just want to thank them for, you know, answering questions and providing information. The second figure, five, is the number of people on the city council. And obviously this is the decision-making body that has made inappropriate decisions about use of ratepayer money, and in some ways have made the lives of 1,085 people a little bit more challenging. And I think, you know, you're all on the way towards restoring, you know, public confidence about the use of ratepayer dollars, and our goal at CUB is just to try to help move that along. Now, there will be really serious challenges since, you know, as the earlier presentations mentioned, the major drivers of rates in both arenas are the environmental regulations and infrastructure maintenance and replacement costs. Now, there are positive developments, so just to kind of give you an outline of the initial set of findings. There are some positive developments mentioned on page 2. On page 2 and 3, there's some discussion of some budget concerns. Construction issues, kind of on 3 and 4. Pages 4 and 5, there's some history outlined. You know, anybody who has, you know, corrections to that history, I would, you know, happy to hear it, but it's kind of what I've been piecing together. And there, it's included to inform suggestions for process improvements along the lines of strengthening the PERB. Beginning on page 6, there's an initial set of kind of longer-term budget issues that are identified with some preliminary discussion. Like I say, it's just the beginning of the list. More will come up, and in particular, one that's not here, partly because I kind of knew it was already on your radar screen, but I'm also, you know, just that's kind of one of the next topics I'm moving into, does relate to the wholesale side of things, which is a huge piece of this puzzle. And then the final section highlights some upcoming issues that may not otherwise be on your radar screen. So by no means I'm going to go through everything, but just to give you an overview of what's in here at this stage of time. So on page 2, just to highlight only one of the positive developments, you know, it was really striking to me to kind of go back and to see how infrequently there's been one commissioner in charge of both the utility bureaus. And I think that was a really good move. And you know, it might seem really simple. I just think it's going to pay off in ways that we're going to yet to see just how its advantages. But that's wanted to highlight that. In terms of the budget concerns, you know, in the requested budget, BES did want to cut a contribution a little over $400,000 for streets sweeping work done by the Portland Bureau of Transportation. But, you know, the Green Streets projects and other efforts of BES have significantly reduced the street sweeping role in addressing, you know, water quality concerns and stormwater management. And I know that, you know, initial requests got whittled down and it was, you know, cut in half. And I just need to identify that I think on a scientific basis, even though, you know, that trimming of that cut request just really wasn't justified.
Ms. Townsend,
I guess
can't help but jump in here. I mean, a lot of what we pick up when we're sweeping streets are leaves. And when leaves cluster around the grates, then they can prevent water from flowing into the storm sewer grates. And that, I mean, I think has some effect on the ability of the storm sewer to avoid flooding. Also, by virtue, I mean, BES is doing a lot of green stuff and adding more vegetation to help control stormwater, and that's good, but we're the ones who wind up picking up the leaves. Mm-hmm. Finally, BES only pays a small fraction of the overall street sweeping budget, and it's kind of hard for us in PBOT to believe that if we did nothing in terms of street sweeping, that would have no effect on the overall cost of BES and dealing with stuff that gets into their source. So that's all I'm going to say, but I could not resist making that comment.
Right. So, but it just speaks to I mean, I think it's good that we're seeing a relatively small concern about this whole, like, oh, is this something that's verging into the use of ratepayer dollars? It's just a little bit off track. And it's helpful to get that, you know, additional information. Like I say, I think it's, on one hand, it's positive that it's a relatively small piece of the puzzle, but it does seem like a trend that should be continued. The other note is the, you know, mayor's budget note directed the Water Bureau to implement, you know, monthly billing to all residential customers with absorbing increased costs within the existing rates. Now, this is really a great goal, and one that's a particular concern to CUB, given the financial burden of quarterly bills that face most of the residential customers. But, you know, this is a big task. It needs to be done in ways that it avoids, you know, setting off bigger problems that maybe weren't anticipated. You know, the goal needs to be clarified. Background from the Water Bureau, you know, needs to be pulled together. And in general, a range of options identified, rigorously assessed, and, you know, final selection based on, you know, the best balance between, you know, cost and benefit. So, you know, in the written testimony, include a few more details. I do, though, want to highlight the suggestion that I know kind of has come up in the past and seems to have dropped out of the picture. So, you know, and maybe there's good reasons for it dropping out of the picture, but just want to renew a thought that, you know, pulling all of the staff working on water and wastewater billing into the Water Bureau's customer service unit maybe needs to, you know, come back up into consideration.
I might just pause on that for a second if I can. That is, I appreciate your highlighting that, and we may need to clarify the language, but the intent of that budget note was to make sure that the Revenue Bureau, the Water Bureau, and BES develop an actionable proposal this year for moving to monthly billing, not monthly meter reading.
Right. No. And that's, you know,
big difference in
exactly.
Cost.
Well, I think, you know, from our point of view, since we've already debuted monthly billing and it's available for people willing to pay electronically.
Right.
If the purpose of the budget note is between now and January to come up with a plan to build it to scale, which is our shared goal, that's one thing. If the goal is in a budget note to have, you know, 180,000 customers using monthly billing, it's a recipe for disaster. So my hope is we can find some balance between the aspiration, which we share at the utilities, for getting the monthly billing. Frankly, the chart that David had in his presentation about other utility bills, if I got a quarterly bill from Comcast, I'd have a lawyer on retainer. I mean, it would be shocking.
That's why they don't do it.
So, this is a helpful discussion because I think the mayor knows that the bureau, that the utilities are committed to getting to monthly billing. We've been a little conservative in our rollout, in part because there have been some computer glitches in the past in this and other bureaus, which we wanted to avoid. But there's also a cost factor. And there are some technology issues. And if we shift to paper, there's another cost factor. And we are very reluctant to shift to ratepayers some of these costs. But if the goal is between now and January to have a plan, I think that's more workable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we could get broad agreement on.
But the other reason I bring it up is the, you know, the monthly reads are like a whole different beast. And, you know, maybe it never makes sense to go there. But, you know, it just seems like some short, you know, you don't want to have something kind of, you know, because there's a, you're kind of under the gun to do something. So we're going to do this. And then you kind of discover that, well, you know, now we've kind of gone down a road and it's harder to do this next thing. So that's, you know, you know, I know that there's been lots of discussion about this, and just, you know, it's a laudable goal, but, you know, all the definitions need to be defined and make sure that it moves forward in a workable way that also just doesn't cut off options for the future. So in terms of construction concerns, obviously there's been the BES, building cost overruns in the news, and does sound like the council has requested an audit in that regard, removing contract adjustments from consent agendas. Also seems like a really good move. That's one that is going to be particularly monitored by us, since this is a practice that can be rolled back by, a subsequent city council. But on the top of, towards the top of page four, the whole issue of, the concrete leaks, with the new reservoir, it's just a really challenging issue. I mean, in terms of just having the technical knowledge, it's a little bit of checking I was able to do. Leaks in concrete are not a surprise. The question is how much is too much and what needs to be done to make sure it's fixed, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just wanted to toss out an idea to potentially form a construction oversight committee similar to the technology oversight committee that assists, the city council in reviewing technology projects. And even though given the number of capital improvement projects that these two bureaus do, it actually could be a committee that helps, in this case, kind of deal with, oh my gosh, there's, post-construction glitches. Do we need some independent analysis to help us think through, what we need to kind of go after a contractor to fix or whatnot? But it seems like it, could also potentially help with contracting procedures. So,
can I jump in on that for a
second?
Because I think it's a terrific idea, and I think one perhaps follow-up point is to get a sense if there are some other public utilities that do something like this or best practices. One of the things I've learned the last year is that that we need to do a better job describing the construction process, the cost structures, and other things. And a great example is we sometimes get dinged for so-called cost overruns. And what people do is they look in a file and they see a back-of-the-envelope estimate by an engineer before you've ever really thought through the vagaries of these kinds of one-off construction projects. Then there's an ordinance where council authorizes, where there's an estimate and we're given a sense of whether it's a high confidence or low confidence. Then we bid, which is really where the rubber hits the road, because that's people telling us what it actually costs to do it. And then there may be some changes in the scope of the project, which go forward. From time to time, what will happen is someone will look at that file and say, gosh, the original hard cost estimate was the back of the envelope engineer's estimate. The end cost is Y. My God, this is a monster that's gone amok. And yet the reality is they're all the wrong numbers. And it may be that the change in the scope of the project were not cost overruns, but along the way, they said, well, we're going to build a building, but do something else. So we have some other challenges in just being better able to explain to the public the cost structures, why we make certain changes, what's a cost overrun, what isn't, what's the baseline price to look at. And I think having a group like this or something equivalent with some independent oversight might be a very interesting thought for us to pursue. So I'm certainly interested in knowing more about that.
The shifting, kind of continuing through this, on page four, there's two kind of past history points that I'll just let you take a look at. But they do identify some good practices that are underway and some helpful context that I just wanted to mention because it seems like they've been missing in many of the recent discussions about utility agency issues. There's other history kind of related to the PERB and how well what the background is or isn't on, the interaction between the PERB and the overlay that came later in terms of introducing the back process, and also identifying that in the past there's been much more utility-specific, utility review team kind of within the, financial, to provide very detailed financial analysis that, you know, from people who have that experience. And that team in the past both provided technical assistance to the PERB, which I think is part of strengthening the PERB and, you know, having it be a more attractive, body to you know, kind of attract more membership and whatnot, but then it also provided information. So these are just some ideas informed by this history to, again, just kind of recognize that the City Council, you know, does need kind of high-level analysis of public utility operations, that and that these are just really different bureaus than the other bureaus.
I'm very, very, very happy to see that recommendation in your report, because we started talking about that return of the utility review team. I think it was back in 2011 with the charter review discussions, and I agree it's imperative.
Yeah, I remember hearing something about that. And, you know, however, I will highlight that, you know, even though I think there's been past discussions and resources available to also then, you know, increase, you know, deal with some of these timing issues that also came up. But, you know, the most important thing is after doing work to make sure you're getting better information, you know, to you, is that then obviously you're the group that needs to listen.
So let me just ask you a question, though. If we were to revisit the utility review team in the budget office, would it be appropriate to fund those positions with rates?
I think so. I'm pausing a little bit because I'd want to just circle back with you, you know, to think about it some more. But my initial reaction is yes.
Thank you. I'd appreciate you thinking about it and giving us some advice, because the reason that we weren't able to do it is because we were trying to do it with general fund and we didn't have enough.
Mm-hmm.
And also trying to keep the rates down, of course. But right. I think the return on investment of that particular staffing, to me, would make it worth spending rates on. Mm-hmm. But I'll look forward to hearing your considered response.
So in terms of, like, the longer-term concerns, I'm not going to touch on all of them, but on page 7, kind of the first full bullet there, certainly an intriguing issue that I was, you know, kind of pleased to learn about is occurring at BES that I want to, move more, kind of dive in and learn more about, is use of this net benefit cost ratio methodology with regards to some of the hard infrastructure and kind of moving that into the green infrastructure. That is a new field kind of across the country. It does seem like, you know, BES particularly well positioned to be a leader in that. There's lots of work kind of in process on developing the next round of CIP planning with a lot of green infrastructure. And, you know, that's, you know, I think for CUB, the key factor is continuing to document that it's cost effective. All indications are that it is, but, you know, that just is a concern.
Janice, on that point, mm-hmm. One thing we're trying to do now that's different is on some of our significant projects like Tabor to the River, we've actually come to council and given them a briefing on the costs. One sort of a cost estimate based on mostly gray traditional, and one gray and green, and with an effort to quantify what the cost savings are over time and why. And I think that serves a couple of purposes. One is that it underscores the value to ratepayers of investing in nature, which saves money. But two, it also it educates the public about why green infrastructure is in the long-term interest. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to try to institutionalize that so as sort of big projects come forward, we give the council both sides of the ledger and show why we're opting for a gray and green approach and what the positive benefit to ratepayers is.
Before you move on, you skipped on page 6 the suggestion that the City Council has a citywide summary for environmental education programs.
Well, I just wasn't going to necessarily touch on absolutely
everything.
No, I know,
but I wanted to highlight that, because I don't get to speak with you as often as Commissioner Fish does, perhaps. I'd like your assessment and advice on whether that is an appropriate use of water and environmental services money, and how, because I had actually asked Parks, we're looking into at the same question.
Mm-hmm.
And also the overlap, we've been asked to fund outdoor school. We have in the past. We aren't funding it this year from general fund. So there's overlap with the city programs too, and I'd be very interested to hear CUB's assessment of not only the work that the city bureaus do, but also the work that we contract with watershed councils and others to help us with.
Mm-hmm. Where I did want to just go next in terms of, like I say, not touching on every single of these bullet items, though, is the conservation discussion on page 7. Now, you know, it's very counterintuitive for CUB to kind of be saying this, because in terms of advocacy on the energy arena, ratepayers, definitely benefit from conservation. It just is really different with regards to water, and I think it just raises some questions of, yes, there are, you know, conservation planning requirements out there. There's obviously interest from consumers, though, you know, a lot of, you know, so-called passive conservation is already occurring, you know, but something we're going to take a look at and have some, you know, some meetings, you know, in the process of being scheduled with the Water Bureau to learn more, but just to raise the idea that there may be a need to think about, yes, you need to do the reactive conservation work, you know, what's either, you know, customers want to respond to that and what's required, but, you know, what if any proactive conservation work really does make sense is just something else we're going to be thinking about and getting input on. Like I say, it's good that's kind of not, you know, that could be surprising to people given the conservation ethic that kind of holds, you know, in Portland. But I wanted to highlight that. And then the final of the list to highlight is just the bullet that begins on the bottom of page 7, continues on to the next page, about the retail water rate structure being very simple. Now, simple can be really good, and I want to stress that, you know, after looking at this, we may end up still suggesting that simple remains good, and let's just kind of keep it the way it is. But there's the, you know, and that could be particularly true in terms of, like, the volume rate issue and having one rate in terms of, like, the water use, because so many times different rate structures on that side are linked to conservation, which, like I just said, you know, just isn't as much of an issue. But it is kind of striking regarding base charges that, you know, Portland has moved away from, you know, the standard industry practice of setting base charges on a cost of service basis. And, you know, lots, you know, history there, lots of, you know, things to think about. So that is just identifying another topic that we will be reviewing and may come up with some suggestions. Like I say, it might end up, you know, saying simple is good. And, you know, when you think about it, on a simplicity to complexity scale from 1 to 10, you know, Portland really is at a 1. And, you know, I think all we're talking about is, you know, a 2 or 3. I mean, there are utilities that have just, you know, very complicated rate structures, and they are primarily in those areas where conservation is a big issue, and the rate structures are helping drive that. And so that's why, even if we do some tweaking, I think we're still going to end up with a rate structure on the simpler end of the spectrum.
And I guess one of the things we'll be looking at closely is a potential consequence of changing base charges is cost shifting. So we'll be looking closely at who the winners and losers are when you do that, with a particular eye, I think, to our residential customers.
Right, and that is indeed why, you know, the whole shift, you know, kind of occurred in the first place, and that is a big concern to CUB. So, yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that. So, I mean, those are the, you know, things I wanted to highlight. From that list, I did at the tail end just add, you know, identify three upcoming issues that just may not yet, you know, yet be on your radar screen. And for example, you know, but you know, the Superfund is not on that list. It's definitely coming, though the timeline seems to keep moving. But it's, you know, the only reason it's not there is because I strongly suspect that that is already on your mind. So these are just trying to potentially be some things that just might not already be on your radar screen. So with that, that's kind of the things from the memo I wanted to highlight. And thanks, and we'd be happy to answer other questions.
This is very helpful, and obviously all of us are going to want to read the full memo. I guess I would add one more to the upcoming issues list that, unlike the Superfund, probably hasn't fully gotten onto all of our radar screens, and we're not quite sure what it is yet, but that's the recertification of the Columbia River levees. Since we've assumed storm drainage responsibility, or at least partially so, for that part of the city now, and we are funding a portion of the engineering work with general fund dollars, the question will arise, what's the cost, how's it get paid for, and to what extent is it rolled into stormwater rates? And we don't know the answers to any of those questions, but we, like Superfund, need to start thinking about them.
Yeah. Any other ideas along those lines? I'm, you know, keep me posted.
Dennis, first of all, this is a superb report. There's a lot of tough love in here. It's a mixture of recommendations and admonishment. And I think what people need to remember is you and CUB are completely arm's length of the city. We don't fund you. While we invited you to come in and perform this role, you're funded by ratepayers that see a value in your service. And you perform a completely independent arm's length process. In fact, Janice and I have spent virtually no time together in the preparation for this because, and I had not actually seen this before it was issued today, and that is to protect the independence of this process. As I was listening to your report and reading it, though, I thought back to really the person who had the idea of beginning this conversation, that's Commissioner Novick. I'm the fourth commissioner in charge of the Water Bureau in the last 2 years. Commissioner Novick is the second of those four. And it was really his idea, and then the council embraced it. And I want to do a shout-out to Steve because I think this first hearing in what's going to be a long and, I think, productive relationship vindicates why this was such a great idea.
Just to clarify, it was actually Bob Jenks's idea at CUB, and Bob walked into my office and said, "So, Steve, I get all these calls from people complaining about water and sewer rates and wanting to know what I'm going to do about it, and I can't because I'm not part of your process, so what about just bringing me in?" So, actually, I think that the ultimate credit goes to the ratepayers of Portland who recognize the value of CUB and just assume CUB is already doing something with water and sewer.
A lot of love to go around. I have a process question for you, Janice, because we're creating the rituals that we'll observe on an ongoing basis. So, here we are, the first hearing where you've come forward with a comprehensive set of both recommendations and critiques and questions. How would you, what would be, in a perfect world, the response that you get to this written document?
Well, there's some of these ideas that are, you know, specifically targeted to, you know, the bureaus and suggested, you know, circling back to your office. And so it would be great to hear, you know, if that occurs.
Okay.
But many of these are just mapping out kind of, you know, the areas of research that we're going to continue, and the discussions are preliminary. So I think a lot of it is just kind of, you know, kind of starting to provide a little bit of a roadmap of where we might want to go. And that's why suggestions for, you know, other lanes to explore are welcome. So I think there's a whole set of this that is going to be more identifying for you. We're looking at this, we're looking at this. And, you know, I think as we get information that, you know, at a timely, you know, I'll just work will presumably work with your office as the point person for these bureaus on, like, okay, we now have, you know, like on this topic that was identified in the spring of 2014, we now have this kind of set of findings. So it's going to be a little bit of a mix.
So it sounds like there's a couple of things here. First, I think there should be an official response, Mayor, that the bureaus prepare,
right, I think so,
circulate to the council for comment, and then goes back. That would be the first thing, acknowledging receipt and where appropriate, providing a response. Yes, we embrace this. Yes, this is worth considering. Yes, we'll work with you to whatever. Then there's clearly some things which CUB has identified as longer-term projects. And I think it might be useful for us to create a little grid that identifies what's in the pipeline, what they're working on, and then have some way of giving the council periodic updates on where we are in that process, so that there's a reasonable timeline and a set of expectations. And all this we're going to make up out of whole cloth, although you do have the experience of working with private utilities statewide. So what I will commit to on behalf of the of water and sewers, we'll work with you to come up with a format, a written mm-hmm. format for responding to suggestions, for creating a matrix of next steps, and for doing so in a way that ensures that the whole council is engaged in that process, because you're not directing these to me, per se. You're directing to the council as a whole, mm-hmm. which has the oversight role. And then I think there's the related question, Mayor, which is it strikes me that a number of these thoughtful suggestions are ripe for consideration by a Blue Ribbon Commission,
mm-hmm.
and may we may get a second bite of the apple at getting some feedback from a commission on these, which we'll want to talk about. But I want to just begin by thanking you for the thoughtfulness of these suggestions, the comprehensive nature. I know I've been getting good feedback from staff about, you know, the early dialogue, and I'm pleased that you called out that you're getting the cooperation you need.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say this is a very promising start to this new relationship, and I want to thank you for your work.
Same here. I think the other thing I'd like you to think through, and that is how does the Cubs report get reviewed or interact with the work of the PERP?
Okay.
We have citizen advisors engaged through the Bureau Advisory Committee and the PERB. They're doing great work. They are not wholly independent of the city, but they are citizens. And then we have CUB playing its role as a wholly independent watchdog organization. So I think all of us are interested in how we think that should work and provide the maximum amount of credible oversight of what we're doing at the city. So your attention to that question would be appreciated as well.
Certainly, and just to circle back a little bit on your matrix idea, I mean, what would also be really helpful is, you know, as that matrix is built, is, you know, I'm having really just kind of gotten started, I'm not going to be at all surprised if the bureau's report back to you, it's like, oh, well, here's this that we're already doing, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I don't, pretend to, you know, have at this early stage, you know, gotten up to speed on absolutely, you know, everything that's going on. These are big, complex agencies with a lot of really hardworking staff, and, you know, making sure they get a chance to fit things in is very critical as well.
Does CUB find, in respect to its relationships with other utilities, that it is best to have a single point of contact with the Bureau, or does it vary with the issue and the context? Jeff, you want to opine on that?
Yeah. He's the guy who's been around a little bit, has more of the
just
private
in terms of structure,
history.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. For the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board. Commissioner Fish, I'd say that generally the answer is a lot of points of contact is probably helpful, because whether you're talking about these bureaus or other private utilities, they are complex organizations, and people really specialize. And so if you need some specific information, it's good to know who to go to get that information that you need. And so we're We're generalists, and we can, but rather than sort of having a bottleneck and then trying to figure out and have everything go through, we've found it helpful just to have the ability to have relationships with people throughout the various companies that we work with and here, the various bureaus, to, you know, get the information we need to, on behalf of ratepayers. And so that's what we found to be useful.
Well, that's great. And my sense is the way we're structured as a government, you'll have those direct relationships with people within the organization that have expertise and information, and you'll always be able to come to a Jim Blackwood